We're glad to have you join us today for this incredible story of transformation. Today's program will be recorded. Family, my name is Heidi H. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater and your moderator for the workshop. Let's begin by having everyone unmute and join me in the serenity prayer. God,
God, grant me the serenity to
accept the things I cannot change,
the
courage
things
to
I
change
can,
the things that I can't,
and
and wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
Amen.
Okay.
You are all muting yourselves. I would like to ask Lori to please read the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous.
Hello, my name is Lori. I'm a food addict and compulsive overeater. 12 steps of OA. One, we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves
Yes,
could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thanks for letting me read.
Thank you. Would Angie please read the 12 Traditions of Overeaters Anonymous?
Yes, happy to. Angie, food addict, the 12 Traditions of OA. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon OA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for OA membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or OA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. Six, an OA group will never endorse, finance, or lend the OA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every OA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Overeaters Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, OA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Overeaters Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the OA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need to always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, television, and other public media communication. And 12, anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all these traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personality.
Thank you. And would Anne-Marie please read the OA Unity with Diversity policy?
Sure. Hi, I'm Anne-Marie. I'm a food addict. Unity with Diversity policy. The Fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous encourages and promotes acceptance and inclusivity. All are welcomed to join OA and are not excluded because of race, creed, national religion, nationality, religion, gender identity, sexual orientation, or any other attribute. We welcome all who share our compulsive. Everyone with the desire to stop eating compulsively is welcome in Overeaters Anonymous.
Thank you. Thank you to everybody who's read. Our speaker today is Harlan G. from Scottsdale, Arizona. And for the workshop today, I'd like to explain how it's going to run. Harlan will share his incredible story of transformation for about 45 minutes, and afterwards it'll be time for questions and sharing. Then around seventh tradition time, we're gonna take about a 5 minute bio break and let Harlan grab some lunch if he needs that, and forever else the needs that you will have as well. Then Harlan will delve back into the world of early AA, focusing on Ebby, Dr. Silkworth, and Hank Parkhurst, and then our founder, Roseanne. There will be then, after that, time for questions and sharing. So thank you, Harlan. You have given your, I'm a little ahead of it. We are grateful you're here today. And with that, I will be quiet and welcome Harlan G.
Today, I am overwhelmed in my life today with miracles of God and the miracles of this fellowship and this program, but that has certainly not always been the case. I have been a compulsive overeater from the moment I was born. I never had any memories of my life where food and my weight were not topic one of conversation. I have very vivid memories of coming into the world and hearing people yelling and screaming at my mother and father. This is kindergarten, pre-kindergarten, screaming at my mother and father, doctors, other parents of kids, their friends, about how fat I was and why are they letting me eat this and why are they letting me eat that. And it was topic one. And from the moment I was born, I have been assaulted by the world that I was born into. And when I say assaulted, I use the term lightly. The world sent me a signal. Loud, clear, impactful, that you, young man, are unacceptable because you're fat. And as long as you are fat, there is something wrong with you. You are never going to get to play on the baseball team. You are never going to get a girlfriend. You are never going to get a good job. And you will never fit into the world that you were born into. There is something wrong with you if you are fat. And what I got as a signal was the reason that I was fat was because I was lazy, I was stupid, I didn't care about my mother, I didn't care about my father, I didn't care about myself, I had no discipline, I had no willpower. And all I needed to do was push myself away from the table. And if I were to push myself away from the table, and if I cared about my father and mother and the world and myself, I would do that. And I need to exercise, and I need to do push-ups, and I need to do sit-ups, and I need to do this, and I need to do that. And there wasn't one thing that these people were telling me that wasn't true. I did not get a girlfriend. I went on my first date with a girl. I was 35 years old. Girls are not going to tolerate fat boys. Not in this world, not in this lifetime, they're not. And I found it to be true that I didn't get a good job. And I found it to be true that I was unaccepted by the world. And yet there was something inside me, something about me where I could not stop once I started and I couldn't stay stopped. I remember very distinctly when I was 7, 8 years old, I started going on diets. 7 and 8 years old, I'm going on diets. And the only diet I knew was to eat less of what I was eating. And I was eating a lot of chocolate. I was eating a lot of God knows what. And I would cut down on those things in hopes of losing weight. And I don't know whether I lost any weight or not. I don't think so. because I couldn't stay on those diets for anything like more than a few days. I couldn't do it for more than just a few days. And the world around me was a very, very scary place to me. And if you were to ask me what I was feeling when I was 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, whatever, if I had the ability to be honest with you, which I did not, I would have told you I was scared to death. And if you would have asked me, well, what are you scared of? I would have said, if I had the capacity to be honest, everything. Girls scared me. Adults scared me. The world scared me. Life scared me. I could not get out of that fear. And I was angry because it seemed to me that other people had this reservoir of willpower that I did not get issued to me at birth. And that I saw parents of children that I knew. They would take a sandwich, a hamburger, a peanut butter sandwich, whatever it was, and they would break it in half. And when they would give one sibling a half a sandwich and the other sibling a half a sandwich, neither sibling could finish their half of the sandwich. What ocean of willpower, brains, character, concern, discipline did they have that I could not achieve? How is it that they were so easy? It was so easy for them. They were so easily dissuaded from eating beyond a normal level. How is this possible? And the only thing I could come up with was they were smarter than me. They were better than me. They were people that I looked up to because they didn't eat the way I ate. When I was 9, I remember going to the doctor, Dr. Jacobson, in Chicago. I'm from born and raised in Chicago. And I'm a Devon Avenue boy. I'm from Devon Avenue. I went to Mather High School in Chicago. I attended William Green Grammar School till 6th grade and Clinton for 7th and 8th. And I graduated high school in 1972 from Mather High School in Chicago. But I remember going to the doctor when I was 9 years old. And the doctor started screaming at my mother in Yiddish. And my mother started screaming back at him. And every time I would go to the doctor and they would give you a diet to follow, it was always in pink. I don't know if any of you can remember that. Way back, I'm going back now to 1962, 63, 64. The diets that the doctors gave you were in pink. I don't know why they assumed that everybody that had a weight problem was female, but I'm living proof along with others here today and those who are not here, that that is far from the truth. Anyway, on this particular day, I got a diet to follow and my mother got a prescription to fill for me. And it was for diet pills. And I remember very distinctly being on these pills. And at the bottom of the prescription, it said to curb appetite. That's what it said. These pills were designed to curb appetite. And I thought, my ship has finally come in. Life is going to be perfect. Life is going to be fantastic. Life is going to be a dream, and everything is going to go my way now. Well, I found out that those pills are horrible. And not only are they horrible, but when you get off the pills, and the only way I can describe it is a roller coaster. When you hit the bottom from those pills, I was eating Illinois and most of Wisconsin anyway. So while I was on the pill, I didn't think about food at all. My brain would race uncontrollably, like it says in the big book, my brain raced uncontrollably. I couldn't really hear what people were saying to me. When people would talk to me, whether they were my teacher or my friend, or they were on TV or whatever, it sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher, you know, walk, 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 walk. I just couldn't listen fast enough. And I get accused of this now, but I would eat, I would say the same thing a million times. And then Marilyn Monroe died in Los Angeles. Marilyn Monroe's death from the diet pills really kind of shook up the medical community, because up until then, these diet pills were considered a panacea. They were considered a utopia, because here we finally have the answer to the obesity question in these pills. And what they did with me was I lost weight on the pills, yes, but I went from a pink pill to a blue pill. And instead of taking the pink pill three times a day, I took the blue pill four times a day with exactly the same results. And then the medical community, this is around the time after John F. Kennedy was killed. I'm going into 1964, 65. The medical community was shaken up by some of the side effects of these pills. So they pulled me off of them. It's a miracle to this day that I wasn't a drug addict, because I hated what these pills did to me, but I loved what they did for me, because they killed my appetite. I mean, they just killed it. And I never remember ever overdoing drugs, ever. I'm just not, drugs and alcohol just never appealed to me. If I've had 10 alcoholic beverages or 15 alcoholic beverages in my entire life, that would be a lot. And I never probably finished one of them. I don't like it. I don't like the smell of it. I don't like the taste of it. And I would ask myself, why am I going to drink liquor if I can have a McDonald's milkshake? Why am I drinking liquor if I can have, a Coca-Cola, or, you know, I'm going to eat food for the calories. You know, I'm going to go, you know, eat, you know, greasy hot dogs and fries at the Red Hot Ranch on Devon Avenue that somebody's grandmother owned. Why would I do this? You know? So the bottom line is that liquor never called to me, drugs never called to me, but I loved what those pills did for me, and that is they effectively shut down my appetite, but they also made me crazy. You sleep about 20 minutes a month. You get every cold and every flu that's around because you don't sleep. Your resistance goes to nothing. My grades were, I was never a great student, trust me, but I was flunking, and they didn't know what they were going to do with me. And I'm an eater. I am not a fighter. I'm getting into fist fights at school. I'm nuts. I mean, these pills are getting me crazy. So when I was about 10, they pulled me off of it. And by the time I was 11, 12, 13, the world was zooming past me at an unbelievably accelerated rate because of puberty. And my friends were losing interest in hanging out with me, although I love my friends and they love me. They were a lot more interested in talking to the girls and seeing which girls they could go out with. And that excluded me completely. And if somebody would have said to me when I was 15, 17, 18 years old, that it would be another 17 years until I reached 35 before I would ever go on a date with a girl, I don't know, but I probably would have tried to kill myself a lot harder. And I wanted to die. I desperately wanted to die. And I was 335 pounds as a senior in high school. I was 500 pounds by the time I was a sophomore in college. I was 600 pounds by the time I graduated college. My mother had been very sick my entire life, mentally ill as well as physically ill. My father was much older than I was. He was 54 years old on the day I was born. And as a much older father, he could not do the things with me that other dads could do. He also was very, very not a good businessman. He really was not. And he had his little business, but we were always one flat tire away from the street. We were always one flat tire away from ruin. And this is how I lived. And this is how my psyche was developed into a fear-based situation. I was always scared to death of what I was hearing from them. And they fought constantly. How I was ever conceived, how I was ever born, is still a mystery. I think if anybody ever uncovers the secret of it, they'll probably win a Nobel Prize. Because these were two people, my mom and dad. I never even saw them be nice to one another, let alone affectionate. They were just constantly, constantly fighting. And I became the head of the household when I was a kid. They abdicated to me. I had no discipline. I had no rules. I had no parameters. They couldn't discipline me. My dad was, by the time I graduated high school, he was 72 years old. And my mother was totally out of it. And the world, I wanted to go to an away university. My grades, my parental, you know, responsibilities to them would not allow that. And we didn't have the money for that. So I went to a university in downtown Chicago, Roosevelt University. But I saw the world just zooming by me. And my weight started to skyrocket. And you don't have to be as heavy as I was to understand what was my reality. What was my reality? My reality was I was very lonely. I had friends, but I was very lonely because what I most wanted was female attention, which of course there was no way I was going to get female attention. There's no possible way that was ever going to happen. And I wanted that desperately, still do, but I want it now. I have it, but I still do. And it was extremely difficult for me to reckon with how easily the boys and the girls in my world fell into relationships, that they didn't have to achieve anything. They didn't have to go out and do anything. Their zing factor, that sexual component of their look, came about as the result of just having birthdays. And it made me angry that I couldn't achieve that. I couldn't hook into that. And I missed out on all that. You know, I'll never be someone's first love. I'll never be someone's summer crush. I'll never be someone's, remember when we used to go out, you know, in high school, you know, I go to all the reunions. They'll pass out a thing. Who did you have a crush on in high school? All of them. Who had a crush on you in high school? None of them. You know, who did you go to homecoming with? Nobody. Who did you go to the prom with? Nobody. You know, so it's painful even now to think back on everything that I missed out on a very important, I missed out on a very beautiful part of life. But I was concerned with my parents and that, but my life wasn't functioning. I was way morbidly obese. I could barely walk. I could barely stand. I broke furniture. I couldn't get in and out of a car, you know, and I'm not that old. I mean, at the time I wasn't that old. Now I'm 69. I'm an old cocker. I'm an old fart, but then I was young. And I could barely walk without pain. I could, you know, and it was just horrible. And I couldn't wear underpants. I had towels shoved between layers of flab to keep it from rubbing together. And I would get that contact dermatitis. I hope you don't know what I'm talking about, because if you do know what I'm talking about, then you know the pain of this disease. And it was very hard to find clothing. And don't you kid yourself about kids from the 60s marching to the tune of their own drummers? Bullshit. We all wanted to look just like everybody else. We all wanted to wear the clothes. And it was the days of skin-tight Levi's and skin-tight, they used to call them trimsters. The pants had the pocket on the top, on the front, and they were called trimsters. And if you look back on the 60s, you see all the women and all the men, everybody is in skin-tight garments. The women were in skin-tight mini, mini, mini skirts, and the boys were in skin-tight clothing. And I couldn't wear any of that. I had to wear clothes that went out of style before World War II. And my dad used to take me into Albany Park. And there was somebody there that could fit me with clothes. It was hard to find clothes for someone that obese. And it was stuff that went out of style decades and decades before. And that accentuated my feeling of being different. I couldn't look like them. I couldn't dress like them. I couldn't date like them. I couldn't run and jump like them. I couldn't be on the team. I couldn't function. And it wreaked its havoc on me. It wreaked its havoc on me. And the only solace I had was in the Milky Way bars and the pizza and the French fries and the cheeseburgers and all the rest of the crap that I was shoving in my mouth. And that was, it was like an insane collusion cycle. The more I ate, the worse my life got. The worse my life got, the more I ate. The more I ate, the worse my life got. And the worse my life got, the more I ate. And it was just endless. It was just endless. When I was 22, my mother died. When I was 24 years old, my father died. So at 24 years of age, I am completely alone. I do not have brothers and sisters. I do not have cousins, aunts, uncles. I don't have any of that stuff. I was really alone. And if it wasn't for my friends and some of their parents, I don't know what my fate would have been. And on February 2nd, 1979 was a Friday. It was a Friday night. One of the parents of one of my friends who lives, she's 92 years old, God bless her. She lives 5 minutes from me here in Scottsdale, Arizona. I owed a lot of money. I was writing bad checks to anybody stupid enough to take them. I lied when the truth would have been better. I lived in filth and squalor. I drove without automobile insurance. I had my car repossessed twice. I was a laughingstock. Children and adults would laugh at me when I would go in public. I was an object of ridicule by the entire world. The obese American is the last bastion of ostracizable humanity. You wouldn't sit there, hopefully, and make fun of somebody because of the color of their skin like that. You wouldn't hopefully make fun of somebody who was legitimately handicapped. You wouldn't make fun of somebody because of whatever. But if someone is morbidly obese, we are open game to any wiseacre with a biting thing to say. And I had to pretend that it didn't bother me. On February 2nd, 1979, I was dragged to my first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous at the Orchard Mental Health Center, God likes to laugh too, in Skokie, Illinois on Niles Center Road. It was a 7 o'clock meeting, freezing cold, miserable night in February. And I had to go to these meetings. I owed a lot of money and I had to go. And I don't remember much about the meeting, but the meeting at that time was live. It wasn't like Zoom like now. It was a live meeting in Skokie. There is one person that I do know is still active in program. She's in her mid-80s, and she is still active in program. She was at my first meeting, and I looked around the room, and I saw a bunch of people that looked very much like what I see today. Relatively normal weight women. I believe there was two men there, me and a guy named Larry, and there was a guy named Art that used to come once in a blue moon, but there were two men and probably 70 women. Now, this was in the days of the treatment centers, which pumped a lot of population into OA. I mean, a lot. It was not uncommon for me to go to meetings where there was 100, 150 people. And we had huggers, greeters, and secretaries and treasurers for every meeting. And the hugging freaked me out. I was scared to death of the females, scared to death. And I didn't want the guy to hug me. So I would deliberately come late so I could avoid as much of the meeting as I could. And I would leave early. I would eat my way to the meetings, and I would pray for a Russian airstrike during the meetings, and I would eat my way home. I did not want to be there. I remember going on a Bill Bluestein retreat. If some of you are really old timers, you will remember Bill Bluestein. He wrote a book called Compulsive Overeater, which is not conference approved, so I'm not recommending it, but he wrote that book. And he also had dalliances with a lot of the ladies in the program. But if you remember him, I went to one of his retreats when I was new in program. I knew Fred Schneider, who started the HOW program. Fred was out of New York, Brooklyn, New York, and he was a school teacher. And he did what school teachers do. He developed a curriculum and of readings and writings. There's no, you know, some of you, I'm probably going to run over here, Eileen, so be prepared. Some of you who are in HOW understand the questions and the writings. There's no writing in the big book about step one or two or three or five or six or seven or 10 or 11, or there's no writing. The only steps that really have writing to them are 4, 8, and sometimes 9. That's it, 4, 8, and sometimes 9. But Fred was a school teacher, Fred Schneider, and he would come back and forth to Chicago a lot because in Evanston, Illinois, if you're familiar, here's Chicago. It's this big matzo ball right here. Here's Chicago, and then you cross over one street at the Northern Extension, and you're in Evanston, and there was a place called First Presbyterian on Central Avenue. There was a HOW meeting. What is HOW? H, honest, O, open, W, willing, and it was very different. OA has evolved a tremendous amount, and I've been here now 45 years. So it is not the same program, but we had, I went there and I met him. We need you, Harlan. We need you. We need you. Okay. Well, whatever. So anyway, there was a lot of writing and questions and this. I'm not knocking that. I'm just saying this is what they had as opposed to what we had in OA. And HOW was a part of OA in those days. So in some intergroups it is, in some intergroups it's not. And I can explain why later, but that's okay. Anyway, they would step you up after step three. You'd do 1, 2, 3, and then you'd have a step-up ceremony. And at the step-up ceremony, they would give you a house plant. I don't know why. I never understood why, but they would give you a house plant. And at step three, flying in the face of the big book, you became a sponsor. You were sponsoring other people in the first three steps. And then step four, they would take like 82 years to complete, which is, again, flying in the face of the big book, but that's what they did. Okay, I don't know how I got on that subject. Oh, I guess I'm thinking about history now. So, okay. Anyway, so I left. I came back. I left and I came back. And when I came back, for the first time in my life, I wanted to see who I could be, what I could be with the one life I had. I had never been on a date with a girl in my life. I had never held a girl's hand except for my mother. I had never in my life tasted life. And I'm not sure I didn't want to die, but I didn't want to live the way I was living. And I saw, now I'm going to talk about me. Not only am I narcissistic by nature, but this is my lead, not yours. But I'm going to say something to you that may not apply to you. So I'm going to pre-qualify by saying, this is what worked for me. I'm not saying I have the answer here, but the answer was the big book of AA. And there was no other answer. I do a Saturday morning big book study every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific time. And we were talking about the title of chapter 2, There Is a Solution. Not only there is a solution, which we're going to talk about when we get to the history, but there is a solution for me. I don't want to make choices because I am very bad at making choices then. Now I'm better. I wanted to make the choice that would make you like me. If I liked the red car and you liked the green car, I bought the green car so you would like me and you wouldn't abandon me, even though I didn't like it. I like the big book. It's beautiful in its simplicity. It works for me. Again, before we have a pogrom and before somebody starts calling New Mexico, I am not disparaging any other method. Not at all. It says in this book, we do not have a monopoly on God. But there were things in this book that they put in that I never saw before. The first one being, if you want what we have and you are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. And I always thought that what we had in OA were people who were thin. I thought that what we had in OA were people who were compulsive overeaters, but they were thin. And I was completely missing the point. Completely missing the point. And God sent me people that I did not deserve, that were above what I deserved. But he sent me people to sponsor me that were God's gift to me. And it was pointed out to me, although very rudely, by a man who was very gruff. And he would say to me, no, that's not what we have. And he explained to me that what we have here are compulsive overeaters who are not eating compulsively, and they are doing so happily, that they are happy in their release. They are content to be neutral toward that food. That's what we have here. And you're willing to go to any length to get it? He'd say, are you? And I said, yes, even though I knew I was lying because I was going to be abstinent 6 days a week. But on Sunday, I'm going to the buffet, the brunch. That didn't work. That doesn't work for me. I'm either doing this or I'm not. Now, the other thing that I saw in the big book was on page 45. It's the thesis line of the entire big book. It says the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And I said, F you on that. Because my father walked out of Europe when it was a graveyard for Jews. before Hitler, before World War II, his entire family was obliterated off the face of this earth, murdered. And for what reason? Hatred? For what reason? These people were murdered. And it made him very angry and scared. And he held very deep-seated resentments toward God, not realizing that God does not create robots that all do the right thing, that he gave human beings free will, and some human beings do horrible things. Once a week, I get this call. How can I believe in God if there's a Holocaust? How can I believe in God when racial tension and chattel slavery, you know, the chattel slavery doesn't exist, but racial tension still exists? How can I believe in God when human beings owned other human beings? How can I believe in God with the Trail of Tears? And my answer is always the same. Is that the hill you want to die on? Are you willing to die? Now, I'll tell you something. If you could convince me that me eating pizza would bring back one person who had suffered an injustice, one person, I will eat pizza with you. But I'll be damned if I'm going to let these haters kill one more Jew by eating pizza. It's not going to happen today. May happen tomorrow, but it's not going to happen today, because human beings are not God and God is not human beings. That there are injustices in the world and there are really lousy things that happen in this world that God is crying to. And when people abused other people, killed other people, owned other people, did injustices to other people, God was crying too. And then I saw something else. It's on page 77. Oh, let me get back to page 45. Now you want me to believe in God. God never came to me in Hebrew school in a synagogue. It was just a series of things. Do this, do that, say this, say that, stand up, sit down. It meant nothing to me. The only thing it meant was it got my mother off my back. And there was sponge cake at the end of the service. So I would grab the whiskeys and trade the whiskeys for more sponge cake. I didn't want the whiskey. I wanted the sponge cake. It says that I'm supposed to believe in God. But what it really says, what was that? Okay. What it really says is, do I believe or am I willing to believe? Somebody's doing something here. I'm going to mute you. Somebody is doing something here. Anyway, do I believe or am I willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself? And yes, because I am not the be-all and the end-all, and my relationship with God is not an event. It is an ongoing lifetime process. And that as my needs change and as my life changes, as I go down the river of life, my relationship with God deepens, gets much closer, and changes if I work at it. And when you first come in, I hate to tell you this, you first come in, don't eat, go to meetings, don't eat, go to meetings, don't puke, go to meetings, don't puke, go to meetings. There's a lot more to this than don't eat and go to meetings. I love when I hear people say, I'm doing 90 and 90. What about day 108? What about day 217? What about day 583? Whatever. I'm not knocking 90 and 90, but look in the macro, not the micro. What happens on day 91? My relationship with God is as such today, and this takes a lot of effort and time. I want to live, and I like my life, and I like me. I hated me. When I would catch a glimpse of me, I hated what it looked like. I'm not exactly, you know, Robert Redford now, but I'm not terrible for a 69-year-old. And I like me because I do self-esteemable things. I don't write bad checks. I don't lie when the truth would have served me better. I pay my bills. I have excellent credit. I own this house. Now, I have a mortgage, but I don't have a car payment. I own my car. I own this house. If I want to spit on the floor, it's my house. I can spit on the floor. And every day, this house gets more and more valuable. And I get closer and closer to God, provided that I stay out of the food and I work at it. Because step 2 and 10 are where the relapse and recover. When you were learning to drive, you put your hands at step 2 and 10. Same thing for recovery. Where does relapse begin most of the time? You're either ingesting allergens or you're not in 2 and 10. Same thing. My relationship with God changes as my life changes. Now, I saw something else. We're getting to the end of the first part. Then we're going to need a 15, 20 minute break because I got to eat my lunch. But here's the deal. But I'll do the questions and answers. But it says on page XX of the foreword to the second edition that of 100 people that came into this program, 50 of them got sober at once. And the other 50, 25 of them got sober. That's a 75% recovery rate because they did it this way. 75% recovery rate. We can't talk about 75% recovery rate. We should be the largest of the 12-step programs by far. Compulsive overeating is a much, 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 much more prevalent problem in our world than alcohol and drugs put together. But we are not. Because it's a difficult program because there's more accountability. Food plans have to change. What's good for you is not good for me. But 75% recovered. We're lucky in OA if we can talk about 2-3% recovery rate. We're not going to get up to 75%, but we can do better than what we're doing. And if we're going to do better, it starts with me. And that means I have to be in recovery. I have to do the work. It's been a long journey. I hope I have not painted you a picture of doom and gloom, because the beginning of my life was beaten down by this disease. This disease putrefied and committed arson to any dream I might have dreamed. This disease took away my ability to live in a world that I wanted to live in. I wanted to die much more than I wanted to live. I didn't get the career I wanted. I didn't get the love of my life I wanted. I didn't get any of that stuff. But what I got was just amazing. I have a life today. I've lost a little over 500 pounds. I have 25 years of abstinence. I have a life today that is worth living. I have a relationship with God and a relationship with people that is endearing and rich and bountiful and rewarding, both for me and for them. I have a way of life that answers all my problems today. And I live my life knowing when I get up in the morning what my job is, what my purpose is. I never have to doubt that God loves me. There are too many miracles. I'm involved romantically with an absolutely beautiful, beautiful woman who I love madly. I love madly. I hope that we make it forever. I hope I never have to let her go. I have a program. I go to meetings every single day. I have the love and richness of relationships with people who both speak and understand the language of the heart. I have the most wonderful miracles in my life every day. This morning, after two knee replacements, two hip replacements, weighing over 700 pounds, doing everything I did to kill myself, I walked 3 miles without stopping. Now it takes me an hour and a half, but I'll settle. I'm 69 years old. I'll be 70 here in just a few minutes. And I do that 3 miles 6 days a week, most of the time. I can fit in an airplane seat. I went to the exhibition games for the Cubs at Sloan Park in Mesa, Arizona, and I fit in the seat. I am no longer an object of ridicule. People do not point at me and laugh at me. I haven't been stuck in a car in a very long time. I can even fit in the back seat of most cars. I have a financial life that works. I'm not a rich man, but my bills are paid. I wish I could retire. Yes, I don't have the money to retire. And I wish I could buy a really nice condo that my lady friend really wants. I can't afford it. It's over my head. God will send us something, whatever. He'll take care of it. I wish I could go back and be young again. I wish I could go back and do it all again with what I know now, but I can't. But I'm going to live my life from today forward, knowing in my heart that there are miracles out there. This is the greatest way of life imaginable. Don't piss it away. Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle. You are going to save lives if you continue to do this work. Bill and Bob and Hank Parkhurst, if you don't know who these people are, you will before we're done. And Ebby Thatcher, they're all dead and buried. They're all gone. They're all gone. God has a job for you. And you can give someone hope that has this disease. You can light them up and give them your truth and your hope. Any idiot can count the seeds in an apple, but only God can count the apples in a seed. And when you start working with other people and you start helping other people to get a recovery from this monster of a disease, you'll remember what it says in the Old Testament. You save one life, you've saved the world entire. You will be that savior for somebody who is out there suffering. Maybe they're extremely overweight. Maybe they're extremely underweight. Maybe they're whatever they are, anorexic, bulimic, whatever they are. God needs you, but you cannot be of maximum service to God and the people about you if you're in the food. You just cannot. So I invite you. If you think that recovery is for the chosen or the few, join me in doing the work. Test God. See if you can find him wanting. I guarantee you that if you will do this work and walk to God, he will run to you. He will run to you with bushel baskets of miracles that you cannot believe. Now, do I have bad days? Yes. Nobody promised me a rose garden. Nobody said, do this work and everything is going to go your way. Don't have unrealistic expectations. Do the work and see where you can find God wanting. And I guarantee you, you will be amazed before you are halfway through. Okay, I've spoken here for almost an hour. I need 2 minutes. I got to go. Behind me here, behind Mr. Potato Head. I'll be back in 2 minutes and we'll do some Q&A and then I got to eat lunch. So I'll be right back. Hold on.
Thank you, Harlan.